friends, let me say first how happy I am indeed to be here. And let's try and make the best of it. The title is a bit overawing, A World Crisis and the Wholeness of Life. I have to do a certain amount of traveling, and last time I was trying to catch a plane at London Airport. There came this awful announcement that the plane will be 2 hours late. Meanwhile, the company will give us a free lunch. And so I went to the restaurant and settled down. And I noticed that next table was being occupied by a young family, father, mother, and a little boy aged 6 or 7. And the waitress came and said, "Can I have your order, sir?" to this father. And the little boy said, "I want fish and chips." But father was still studying the menu at great length. And then he ordered 3 Yorkshire pudding and pie. The waitress said, "One fish and chips, two Yorkshire pudding and pie," and was away. And I looked at the little boy, his eyes nearly fell out of his head, and he said, "Mummy, she thinks I'm real." I had a look at the parents, and they didn't look very real to me. But I suppose that is really what we mean when we talk about the wholeness of life. Anyway, I want to take these words, the wholeness of life, not in an ecological sense. Other people can do this better. But the wholeness in an individual sense. But first we have to talk about the crisis. I wonder if this is a very good term to apply to the present situation. I look upon it as the end of an era. And in a way, it's the end of 3 eras overlapping. Some 300 odd years of philosophical development, which you can say started with Descartes, with the Cartesian Revolution. I think this is coming to an end. Secondly, I think 200 years, it started 100 years later, of a certain sociological development initiated by what is called very imprecisely the First Industrial Revolution. I think this is coming to an end. And thirdly, a century of economic technical development, again, starting 100 years later than the sociological, is coming to an end or to a kind of turning point. It's significant that I'm talking about 300 years, philosophically speaking, 200 years, sociologically speaking, 100 years, economically and technically speaking, because, of course, the philosophy is the basis of these other developments. And so let us look at the philosophers. What happened? Well, perhaps everybody in this room knows it much better than I do, but since it taken me such a long time to fully realize it, I will talk about it in a few words. Descartes, a powerful but evidently extraordinarily narrow mind, he came with a message that only distinct and precise ideas have any value. And distinction and precision means it should be of the nature of either geometry or mathematics. All the rest, he said, is just a waste of time. It's mumbo jumbo. And somehow, owing to certain factors which the historians among us can expound much better than I can, Western humanity fell for this. And this was the Cartesian Revolution, far more important than the Copernican Revolution, which after all is only about astronomy. Who cares about astronomy? Now this touched the center of human life, because our whole tradition had been, as summed up by Thomas Aquinas, who was quoting Aristotle, the thesis, the slenderest knowledge of the higher things is infinitely more desirable than the most precise knowledge of the lower things. That was Christianity, that was Western civilization. And the Cartesian Revolution turned this upside down, saying only what it can be known with absolute precision is worth knowing. The rest is stuff and nonsense. And of course, when you come to think of it, the only thing that can be known with precision is the lowest level of manifestation, namely inanimate matter. These little beggars, they can't help themselves. They must do what natural law prescribes. But already when the factor life comes into it, or consciousness, or self-awareness, then of course precision is out of the window. And this turning around then inevitably, it always takes time, over a few generations, worked itself through society, all thinking, and produced then 19th century materialism, and out of that, what I can only call the religion of economics. And really, at the end of the day, nothing matters except economics. And that is a polite way of saying making money, a high standard of living, a high rate of metabolism, a high standard of living. Now, as we now notice, belatedly, but not necessarily too late, is that this is very hard on human nature. Most people just crack up. It is also very hard on living nature around us, which is being destroyed. And thirdly, it's very hard on the resource endowment of this earth. That is simply, the earth is being raped. It's very hard for people to admit that they are on the wrong track. It's easy to point at others that they are going wrong, but that we ourselves are on the wrong track is hard. I was in Eastern Germany not so long ago, and they were telling me there that Western civilization is like an express train, which is at ever increasing speed is running towards an abyss. But we shall overtake it, they said. So, that's the good old competitive spirit. And it's very hard for us to admit to ourselves that what has occurred in our civilization is, well, I would say the second fall of man. Like people in a lunatic asylum who have illusions of grandeur, so we have still these illusions. Namely, that we, of all people, are now on the threshold of a new higher level of consciousness, the Aquarian age, etc., etc. It is hard for us to realize that what we are called upon to do is not to achieve an unheard new consciousness, but to regain a little bit of the consciousness and the wisdom that our forefathers possessed as a matter of course. Because we cannot let go of our conceits, so we always fasten attention on the latest gadget, intellectual gadget, instead of turning to the real sources which are embedded in our history and are still alive in various places in the world, where without fuss and bother the truth is being found and has been for a long, long time. For this one doesn't need all these newfangled, wonderful, crazy ideas. This is difficult for us, and we have been systematically miseducated and are going on miseducating our children by suggesting to them that until the unfortunate James Watt invented the steam engine, life everywhere was just a misery. And we have been made to believe, and we are making our children to believe, that the cathedrals of Europe were built by miserable people. That all the innumerable craftsmen engaged were in fact trembling on the edge of death from starvation. And that somehow the picture was one of a tiny rich aristocracy grinding the faces of the masses in the dust from out of which they produced these cathedrals. And in fact, the whole of culture, which parts of which we still enjoy. If we can only regain a small part of that sense of the true, the good, and the beautiful, which was possessed by our ancestors, that nobility of bearing, also that knowledge that noblesse oblige, this nobility which you can still see in their creations, and which we cannot in any way match anywhere, then I think we shall have done very well indeed, and probably done all that is really required for our survival. Well, the old era, philosophically speaking, is drawing to a close. It is spiritually, intellectually bankrupt. Philosophy has exploded into an infinite number of absurdities. Nobody really believes anything anymore. Mystics become scientists, and normally very bad scientists. And scientists become mystics, normally appallingly bad mystics. And countless people are inventing new religions. Confusion rules supreme. But at least in all sorts of places, many people have lost this cocksureness, and they are searching, and some are achieving excellence. Just for interest's sake, I will name a few that have impressed themselves on me. People who have recaptured the truth without any sentimentality or delusions of grandeur. People like Ananda Kumaraswamy, who lived most of his life in the United States. The Frenchman René Guénon, who became a Sufi and died some 20 years ago in Upper Egypt. A German by the name of Fritjof Schur, who still lives in Switzerland. And also, perhaps not quite of that class, people like Marco Pallis, Martin Lings, Titus Burkhardt, Syed Nasr, and no doubt many others who have not, by chance, not come to my notice as much as those that, whom I've mentioned. And at the same time, the arrogance of the natural sciences is crumbling. They are discovering that they also have a conscience. All this, I suggest, is adding up to the end of an era, which means, of course, confusion and chaos. And it means that an enormous amount of honest work has to be done to reconstruct real knowledge. And I mean a knowledge which no real civilization has ever been without, and which now needs to be presented in a new dialect so that modern man can understand it. Secondly, I said the sociological phase is coming to an end, which started about 200 years ago. Actually, we are celebrating, for what it's worth, the bicentenary of Adam Smith's fundamental economic book, The Wealth of Nations, in which he idolized the division of labor. Adam Smith was a strange character, coming, of course, from a strange country, as you noticed, it's very difficult to make out, because he also saw what was going to happen. He pleaded for an ever-increasing division of labor and said, this is the source of wealth of nations. And then he said, man is formed by the work he does every day, and when he does nothing but mechanical, stupid work, he becomes inevitably and necessarily, to quote, so dull and ignorant as it is possible for a human being to become. And, believe it or not, this just shows what frightful philosophical confusion we've fallen into. And he goes on to say, this is the fate of the great majority of all people in all advanced and civilized countries. That's what he said. Marx took this up with a certain amount of relish. And with his tremendous insight and penetration, after all, the young Marx, more than 150 years ago, he said an astonishing thing like, now just watch it a little bit. If you have too many useful machines, you get too many useless people. Very few of us have such penetrating insights. Marx himself said with absolute accuracy that any society in which most people do not enjoy their work and are unable to use it as a means of their own development has no chance of long-term survival. This development of this phase where we disregarded all these things and organized the productive system in such a way that most people, I warn you, don't ask them whether they enjoy their work. If you ask them, don't wait for the answer. This phase is coming to an end. It's breaking down. One of the most advanced nations in this respect is the United Kingdom. On the continent of Europe, The situation is cushioned by the presence of 15 million migrant workers. They are not kicking. They have to take anything that's offered. Here we don't have migrant workers. The immigrants that have come, they are not migrant workers. They are citizens. And they are just as much under the protection of the unions as anybody else. If you go to some of the most illustrious, famous, let's say, motor car factories on the continent, you do not find a single native on the assembly belt. These are all migrant workers. That is keeping the system going. But that system has seen its day. In some countries, it has already produced such unmanageability that the bosses have actually reconsidered technology. The shining example, as probably most of you know, is Volvo in Sweden. They just couldn't carry on anymore. And so they have abandoned the assembly belt and they have humanized the work process. Well, one swallow doesn't make a summer, but it's at least a swallow. In Britain, we are exposed particularly strongly to this breakdown, but nothing to worry about, really, because we're only a few years ahead of the rest. It makes the life of management very difficult. It's much easier to manage an industry when you can just tell the chaps what to do, and they touch their cap and do it. But those days have gone. So again, the end of an era with great confusion. One of the things that come from this is inflation, because these people who had been abused by the industrial process, they have discovered their power, and they're using it. They've become irresistible. They can paralyze anything. And here again, it is perfectly possible that something good, new, clean, and beautiful can arise out of it, that we use our tremendous resources of knowledge that has accumulated, particularly under the last, during the last 300 years, that we use it to create what I call a technology with a human face. A technology that is conceived so that people can and will enjoy their work and at the same time is intelligent enough to produce a sufficiently high level of productivity so that a decent standard can be maintained. Now, I can only sketch these things. I want to be tolerably short. Let's move on to the third point. The economic era, technological economic era that is coming to an end. One could say the party is over. It was a strange party. It really got swinging in the last 30 years. Very few of us really appreciate how recent all these things are. As an economist, perhaps I may be forgiven if I just quote one or two figures. You know, we got upset in 1973 and will soon be upset again, that we couldn't get all the oil we wanted at a throwaway price. And say, what are these oil people? I mean, who are they anyhow? Why don't they let us have everything we need, or think we need, for a song? And surely, the situation will normalize itself again. I can assure you the situation is totally abnormal. Only 50 years ago, and as I look around, there are quite a few of us who can remember 50 years ago very vividly. What was the world oil consumption compared with now? Well, I tell you, it was 5%. 5%. Who consumed and who produced the oil? Well, 70% of all the oil was produced in the United States, and 66% of all the world's oil was consumed in the United States. It was virtually a purely American phenomenon. We knew how to get on without it. The total ocean-going transport of oil 50 years ago was about equivalent to the spillage today. If you look at all ocean-going transport today and divide it into two parts, oil on the one hand and everything else on the other hand, in terms of ton miles, the oil is twice as much as everything else. Naturally, the OPEC countries, Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, they have been getting worried. They have been telling us, look, you're taking everything out of our ground in a hurry. In 30 years, if you carry on like this, it'll all be gone. What will become of us? Back to sand and camels. And they sent the Secretary General of OPEC, highly intelligent Algerian, who is now running UNIDO in Vienna, they sent him around to plead with the importing countries, for goodness sakes, mitigate your requirements. We are bleeding to death. Nobody listened. But it's quite clear when you contemplate the absurdity of this, to build up such a degree of consumption on such slender, non-renewable resources, you know that an era is coming to an end. The party is over. During the party, we allowed ourselves to be entertained by at least three magicians, illusionists. The first one managed to convince most of us that, although this is a finite planet, the resources are infinite. The second one managed to persuade many of us that there will always be plenty of people who will do very dirty and mindless work for a pittance. And the third one was probably the most dangerous illusionist. He told us that never mind what you do, if you get into any kind of trouble, science will bail you out. Now suddenly these three illusionists have disappeared, and the party is over, and we are left with the washing up. The third one is the most dangerous illusion, which has had the most extraordinary effects when you come to think of it. We are told on the best authority, and have no reason to doubt it, that there are more scientists alive today than there have been in the totality of previous human history all taken together. So people with an inquiring mind might well ask themselves, what are they all doing? And the answer is, they're all solving problems. And again, thoughtful people might say, well, look, aren't we running out of problems? Oh, no. We've got a lot more than ever before. Really, you know, it's necessary to think about these things and not just go on belting ahead with this kind of nonsense. My own view is that only second-rate people solve problems. First-rate people don't have them to start with. An intelligent man once raised the question along a similar line, If an ancestor of long ago would visit us today, what would he be more astonished at? The skill of our dentists, or the rottenness of our teeth. Perhaps you follow what I mean. It's second-rate people who solve problems. It's the first-rate people who don't have them in the first place. All the same, that was a digression. These three illusionists, they have left. Many people believe that they'll soon come back. Well, the illusion may come back, but only very temporarily. We may go to sleep again, and then the awakening will be even ruder than before. Well, we have come together to consider the world crisis and the wholeness of life. At this stage, I'm inviting you to consider the wholeness of the crisis. This is not one of those fleeting matters. It is not just a matter of pollution, although it's that too. It's not just a matter of political breakdown in various parts of the world, or rising crime rates, or inflation. It's not even a matter of that, just of that awesome and perhaps most dreadful transgression that goes under the name of the peaceful use of nuclear energy. It's not just the energy crisis. It is. It has been said that this civilization will crash, but it will remain unnoticed under the incessant din. It is a total challenge to every one of us, philosophical, sociological, economic, or lifestyle, the lot. Well, so much about the crisis. Now let's look at the wholeness of life. And as I said, I take the words to refer to the individual, not to the ecology as a whole. Other people will do the latter. Now, the first point about wholeness, it seems to me, can be made as follows. There are people who do a lot of thinking and talking, but they couldn't run a fish and chip shop. And there are people who do and do and do, but they have never given thought to anything. So the first point is that wholeness, that which we must aspire to, is that we will take time, no matter how urgent affairs might be, to think clearly, decisively, and then we go and do something about it. I know this is a considerable existential anguish when any one of us comes to the point of asking ourselves, am I only a talker or am I a doer? And it's a plunge into the unknown to get into doing something. Well, I do not want anyone to think that doing is the thing one can do immediately. No, thinking comes first, and the beginning is the word. In the beginning is the word, but then the word has to come down and live among us, has to become flesh, has to become an incarnation. And that incarnation is a materialistic thing. So the first step is to think about these matters, to get them sorted out intellectually. The second step is to diagnose it, to say, now, this surely is extraordinary. At the height of our triumphs, we are bankrupt. How do we understand it? What is an explanation of these astonishing things? Which we've grown to used to and we think they're normal. No, they're the most abnormal things. The diagnosis, however, is also an existentially important thing from this point of view. It's no use coming back with an answer relating to things that we can't do anything about it. People love to do that. Whenever I talk about anything we can actually do about, somebody will get up and say, what about the population? I say, well, look, I can't do very much about it. But he is not interested whether he can do something about it. He is only interested in talking about it. Or the next person will say, you can't do anything until you've changed the political system. No doubt he's quite right. But we must do something to change the political system. And that must be in a material way, not just foaming at the mouth. People always say, how can you help the poor in the world if you don't change the political system? I can only say, if I go into a foreign country to change the political system there, my stay will be either unduly shortened or unduly prolonged. and I can't do any work at all. So we have to identify the forces that I, you, not they, can actually do something about. That we can alter or bend or reorientate to some extent, no matter how little. And what are the forces which have shaped this society, this civilization, and which have destroyed the wholeness of life? No doubt there are many forces, but as I said, we must find those that are important and at the same time capable of being influenced by us, not by some mysterious they or the government. Now, here again we can learn from Dr. Marx, who taught us that you should always study how people make a living, because that is more significant than what they talk. Any intelligent person will do this. It reminds me of Tolstoy, who once said about the Russian intellectuals that they had a great abiding love for the poor, and they would do anything for the poor except get off their backs. Now, how do people make their living? Because after all, people have to make a living. And this is shaped unquestionably, primarily, by technology. And there, I'm now becoming autobiographical, there I said to myself, now this is one of the factors that I can do something about. Something has gone wrong with technology. Now what has gone wrong? I have discovered a certain tendency which I've never found discussed anywhere, but which stared me in the face, which I then called the law of the disappearing middle. It's not such a good message to us. It's not that middle that disappears. In technology, the middle disappears. Now, if you'll give me your imaginative attention, at first there is ordinary tools, spades, hammers, and so on. This is stage one technology. That can never disappear. Then some clever people come and develop a higher technology, stage two. So you have stage one and stage two side by side. And then another lot of clever people come and develop something better, faster. Stage three. Now, I know I'm stylizing this a little bit. Stage two disappears. Now, you don't notice it when there's only stage one, stage two, stage three, because they're pretty close together. But by now, with this year progress, we are at stage 12. Stage one is there. Stage 12 is there, the latest and the best. In between, most of it has disappeared. Some 35 years ago, I was a farm labourer up in, no, didn't realise how far north I was, down south in England. And we had a high-class farming there with animal-drawn equipment, which even a person of modest means could afford to buy. None of it is obtainable today anymore. And today you have to buy tractors and combine harvesters, tractors with 24 different gears, so expensive that even this essential activity of farming is virtually reserved to people who are either already immensely rich or who are slightly crazy, being prepared to rough it in a quite appalling manner. More than can and should be asked of people. The middle disappears, and this produces some quite horrifying effects when you come to think of it, namely that the wholeness of mankind is polarized into the very poor and the very rich with hardly anything in the middle, when you take it on a world scale. Also, that the pattern of settlement, human settlement, is polarized. A few megalopolitan areas with vast congestion and then an enormous emptiness with hardly anybody. On the one hand, in the rural areas, a total decay of culture because of cultural starvation, and in the urban areas, a total decay of culture because of corruption. We had the Habitat Conference about human settlements. Again, one encountered a situation where people took this most abnormal development as normal. And, of course, no one can beat our American friends in coining new words. They were freely talking about the megalopolitanization of the world. I had to practice this for quite a while. If you follow this, you can see again how this polarization inevitably will lead to ecological breakdowns, because the impact which comes from this absurd distribution of mankind over the surface of the earth, nature cannot take, and also leads to unbelievable use of resources. A figure might be of interest. We do look over the Atlantic at the United States, not to criticize but to learn, because they're always ahead of us. We are merely less competent Americans in ruining the world. But when you see the statistics that 92% of the American population live in conurbations, which between them cover 2% of the surface area of the country. And if you turn this round and say, well, therefore, 98% of this enormous country are inhabited by 8% of the population, you can see what I mean by polarization. But you can see it in this country as well, where more than half the surface area of the United Kingdom is scheduled as development areas because they're underpopulated. And down south, in the Midlands and the southeast, we have mad congestion. So once this is, one has come, as I had come, to this kind of diagnosis, then one knows what to do. We have to restore this technological middle. And we realize that, yes, 100 years ago, things were too small, too simple. There was not enough intelligent investment and an ineffective technology. But meanwhile, it has grown mainly into a technology which is too big, too complex, too capital costly, and too violent. These are the four criteria that I select. Other people may formulate it differently. It doesn't matter so much. Now, if the thing is too big and too complex and too capital costly, what does it mean that most of us are excluded? I'll give you an example. I was at one of the most illustrious establishments developing textile machinery. And I was taken through there, and the mind boggles what these machines can do. They can make the most fantastic patterns at fantastic speed. And I asked, how much is such a machine? And I was told £100,000. And I said to the chap who was the boss, I said, it seems to me you can do everything now. And he said, yes, we can do everything. He didn't know I'd laid a trap for him. I said, well, why don't you stop? He said, if you could do everything, it's time to stop instead of going on spending all this money. Do something more sensible. So he said, I can't stop, he said. I'm surrounded by extremely clever people. They can still find improvements. What's wrong with that? Are you against progress? I said, no, okay. I know this, but you see, another stage on, they have so many further so-called improvements that this machine will cost £150,000. So he said, well, maybe it will be 50% more expensive and 100% more efficient. What's wrong with that? Are you really against progress? Just leave it. I'm just a bit worried because there are few enough of us who can buy a machine as it is now with £100,000 and even fewer who can buy one for £150,000. What are you doing to society with all these crazy patterns? The whole of the productive process, which is one of the joys of humanity, to be productively engaged, is being reserved for a smaller and smaller group of humanity. So finally, there are only a few multinational companies who can carry this kind of technology. So this man understood it immediately. And now he really stopped. And he said, but look here, what am I to do? I can't stop. If I go to the principal and say, look, I stop. He says, well, yes, you did look a bit jaded, and we'll just stay on another 3 months, we'll find a successor. You see? No, he can't stop. But if you are involved in a situation where you become doubtful of whether what you are doing is really in toto right, or if it's a situation where there is some goodness but a lot of badness in it at the same time, then you have to think, can I create some kind of a counterweight? So we talked about that. What do you mean by counterweight? Well, why don't you get some of these clever chaps not to make an ultra-complex machine even more complicated, but to take the simplest equipment, which is now still being used by hundreds upon hundreds of millions of people throughout the world, and upgrade that. Then you have really benefited humanity. Then you have democratized the productive process instead of making it more and more the privilege of those already immensely rich. Well, he promised to do it. Probably hasn't done it. But this is the point I'm making, that this is the polarization, there's nothing in the middle, so that more and more people get fixed in unalterable poverty because the whole technology, stage one, is too low and too inefficient. And there's no bridge. So the world gets split and that loses its hold. Well, when one has seen something, one has to do something about it, and I won't delay you too long. So we set up an organization, which the chairman already referred to, the Intermediate Technology Development Group, to reconstitute that middle, an intelligent technology for the little people. Needless to say, but incurs a great deal of ridicule. I don't know how often people have said this fellow seemed to be quite intelligent, but he is a complete crank now. But you have to develop a certain tolerance for these things, and I never myself resented to be called a crank, because what's wrong with a crank? It's a small instrument. It's very simple. There's not great capital investment involved, and it's not totally, but a relatively non-violent technology, and it causes revolutions. One is also told that you can't do anything because of the big people. They would stop it. Well, I have never found this. I say with utmost seriousness that this should never move any one of us, because it's much more satisfactory, if necessary, to be shot down in flames than never even to start your little balloon. But I would say we indeed cannot succeed in turning this round to make it viable again unless we work simultaneously at many different levels. This is not simply a matter of technological ingenuity to produce an efficient small-scale technology. This is why I talked at such length about the crisis. We have to sort out our total philosophy of life. Well, you'll have a whole week for all this, and I wish you luck. The first task, unquestionably, is to clarify these things in our own mind. The second task then is, when the urge comes, what can I do about it, to recognize the people who are already doing something about it and support them. It's quite astonishing how many people are asking all the time, what can I do to save the world? I am so small. And then you find they haven't even joined the Soil Association yet. that they can do. Or other things who are always somewhere in the neighborhood who are already doing something. So that is the second one. After you've sorted out your mind, support those who are already acting. And it doesn't cost very much, but at least it's something. If then you don't find anyone, then of course you've got to do it yourself. But here again, let's not be bamboozled by the idea that unless you can do things in a big way, they're not worth doing. Everything new starts very, very small, normally in a very dark place. I have a sister older than myself, and she is passionately interested in organic horticulture, but she has no garden. But that doesn't discourage her. She has a compost heap on the balcony. And the whole town know her. And she grows extremely good plants there. If we approach these things not with any great highfalutin ideas, but in this spirit, let's do something, even if it doesn't come to more than the compost heap on the balcony. But it can come to more with most of us, wherever we might be. Then I think we are on the way of recapturing, regaining this wholeness, which primarily consists in right thinking leading to right action. Because this is the dignity and the beauty of the human being, that he or she acts, but not blindly, not as a reaction, but knowingly, consciously, and on the basis of insight. If one talks about the light, the university of light, I think one talks very largely about insight. And this insight can only come from this wholeness that we are striving for, and the attainment of which, I believe, is the only real task of human life on this planet. Thank you very much for your attention. One word I didn't use, the word job. I talked about work. We have already, under this technological development, got into the way of thinking that work can be got only when you have a job. A job which means an employer. We talk about unemployment, and we even have the most absurd word in this thing, namely that someone who does his own thing is called self-employed. I think the time where one looks simply for jobs provided by corporations, etc., big organizations, that time is also coming to a close. And what Ivan Illich calls the self-support system will have to be developed quite consciously. Let me enlarge on this for just a moment. We live on two systems. This is Ivan Illich. On the one hand, what he calls the self-support system, that which we do for ourselves. What we do in the home or in the narrowest circle of community. And the other system is the market system that we get other people to do for us against money or possibly barter occasionally. Now what has happened is that during the last 50 years the self-care, self-support system has virtually collapsed. Very, very little. I mean, take the medical field. In my youth, and I did survive my youth, 95% of all ailments in the family were looked after by that excellent medical auxiliary mum. Very simple means, you see. And we only went to the doctor in very rare cases. Mainly, it was a self-support system. And there was the knowledge of how to deal with all these little things. This has ceased, certainly in this country and many other countries that I know. This is finished. The self-support system has disappeared. And for every little thing, one goes to the doctor. I read some statistics. The doctor now in Britain has about 3.5 minutes per patient. In Germany, only 2 minutes, because they, of course, are a far more efficient society than Britain. So, we are not talking only about jobs, we are talking precisely about work. Namely, that the human being is created to first of all, externalize and make something of the potential laid into him or her. If that is frustrated, he or she becomes deeply unhappy and probably very destructive. This is the chance we're given by life, which, as the Buddhists say, is a benefit hard to obtain. Secondly, we are put into this world with a great deal of egocentricity, which is necessary because we have, first of all, to survive. But our task is to overcome this egocentricity. And this we can only do by working with others. Not by playing football with others. I mean, look at it. What happens there, really? No, by being engaged in creative, useful work jointly with others. This helps us to overcome this egocentricity. And thirdly, work is there to provide the wherewithal for living. But that's only the third of them. Now, we have to reconsider all jobs. Do they satisfy these three requirements? Well, we haven't done this for 100 years. We have set only the third requirement, that it is productive. But the productivity is collapsing now, because people are so completely fed up, in most cases, with their work, that they only give one third of what they could give. And it's no use preaching to them. One has to change it so that the work is humanized. Of course, there are these dreamers, and I won't use any worse words, who say, don't bother to humanize work, we're going to abolish it by automation. But when you look at it, they're abolishing the last remainder of intelligent and interesting work, and leaving all this interesting work to automated machinery, and using the human being exclusively as what a German philosopher Nietzsche called the gap filler, where human ingenuity can't quite cope. Now, of course, it's very much easier to do productive processes in a machine than feeding in material and taking away the output. To mechanize that is very difficult. So all the most stupid and mindless work then remains to be done by people. Or even a worse kind of thing, which is not even stupid, because then you don't need your intelligence. No continuous dial watching, or computer programming. You know, where only a very humdrum and low human capacity is being used, but that is used all the time. Logic actually is one of the minor human capacities. It doesn't require a lot of development. Any of you who have watched small children, you know that this is the first phase. It's the smallest children who are the most logical. Most of the time we don't realize it because they're not sufficiently articulate. But if this reminiscence is permitted, Mr. Chairman, I never forget, I used to get up very early in the morning and tiptoe downstairs to have a little bit of time for myself. But the staircase creaks. And I had a young son, aged 4, and sometimes he heard me, and I had just settled down. The door is flung open. In he comes. He rolls over the furniture. And I said, Robert, I actually had come here to have a bit of peace and quiet. And he looked at me with astonishment and said, does Mummy make so much noise in bed? You can't beat the logic of that. Well, forgive me, that's what I mean about work.
Could you keep the questions short and speak up, please?
Dr. Schumacher, you mentioned the revolution, political change. But since it would seem obvious that the bigger you make government, the more trouble you create, what structure do you envision as the best to try to bring out a homeless?
I didn't get the end of the sentence. What do I envision?
What structure do you envision as the best to try to bring out the wholeness?
Well, as I said, I'm only interested in finding points where I can apply my own little lever and do something. So I have no blueprint for a political structure which I couldn't implement anyhow. But I think many of us, all of us, are already doing is to create new, relatively more self-contained structures, which very often succeed in bypassing big government. Or doing one very satisfactory thing, bypassing the tax system. If you do things for yourself, the self-support system doesn't attract taxation, which is one of its beauties. So we can't, a frontal attack never leads to anything except shouting and a hardening of the arteries on both sides. We can circumvent it. But this is not so easy, so a lot of experimentation is necessary. Well, here is a place of this kind of experimentation, a community where a lot is done on the spot, which bypasses a lot of structures.
And a lot of taxes.
That's right, a lot of taxes. Also, it has tucked itself away in a remote corner where the chaps of Whitehall don't often venture to go. It's that sort of thing. If we had here an assembly of the world's prime ministers, one would talk in other terms, more theoretical terms. But two prime ministers of very important countries have said to me in the same words, look, I am only a prime minister. I can't do anything except what the system serves up to me. So even there, the thing is, it's almost stalled. I used to have a recurrent dream after I joined the National Coal Board, which was a huge organization. I dreamt that we were at a board meeting and had a very heavy going discussion with all these worried men there. And finally it was decided to take some action. And in my dream there was a big wall with a panel with all sorts of levers. And it was decided we need to reduce absenteeism, let's say. And somebody would then get up and operate the lever, absenteeism, and then sit down rather exhausted. And they said, well, now we've done something. In my dream I was able to look behind the panel and found it wasn't connected with anything at all. But at the next meeting, you see, a report was made, and has absenteeism actually gone down? And one of three answers was possible. no, it has gone up. And then everybody would say, yes, circumstances are against us. Oh, it has gone down. They would say, well, our policy has been successful. Oh, it has not moved at all. And they would say, it's early days yet. So let's forget about big government. It's one of the dinosaurs. Other people who are inside, they may be able to do something from the inside. Let us create new structures which have a much higher degree of independence.
Dr. Schumacher, you were very clear with the point that we must first think about the situation in which we find ourselves. Would you comment on the proposition that even before thinking about the situation that we need to feel about it, to learn to feel about it?
Well, everything needs a motivation. If you don't feel anything, you won't even think, will you? So I agree with you.
Dr. Schumacher, you mentioned the gentleman with his $100,000 patterning machine and ultimately suggested to him that perhaps he should concentrate on upgrading the stage one equipment. And I wonder if that doesn't just begin the process over again. And in the event that perhaps the gentleman did begin to upgrade stage one equipment, how does one call a halt to it? How does one find the middle?
The story of the egg tray is up too much.
Why are you worried about it? Why don't you take a situation? There are hundreds of millions of people who need help. They're crying out for help. And even in a country like India, where there's so much need, the intellectuals, educated at the expense of society, they go to the periphery of technology, the rich man's technology. So the people are left without any help whatsoever. Now, why can't we help them? Why should we worry whether the help, perhaps in later generations, will lead to wrong developments? Good gracious me. I mean, this is Tolstoy. You see, we'll do anything except get off their backs. The Chinese worked out that it takes the work of 30 peasants to keep one person at university. So if that person has been at university for 5 years, he or she have consumed 150 peasant work years. Well, there was the late Mao Zedong, who said, young person, what do the peasants get back from this? If you go into a comfortable district in Shanghai to live it up with other privileged people, they get back nothing. No, you go into this remote village and help the peasants with your marvelous knowledge. And then the students went there. And they found that what they had learned at university was of no use at all. That if they were doctors, they couldn't help a woman who was giving birth to a child, because they had been trained to be able to do this only surrounded by 5,000 pounds worth of equipment. The local midwife could do it, but she didn't do it very well. So the obvious thing, and this has happened in China, is the students came back and said, hey, what we are learning has no real relevance to real life. We want to learn something that we can go into the village and not make fools of ourselves. So they upgraded the midwife's technology. And I didn't worry their heads whether in the year 2500 perhaps some crazy new fangled medicine will develop. Now they actually helped people. 90% of all freight in India is moved by bullock cart. Well, do the intellectuals, the highly trained engineers, etc., pay some attention to the bullock cart? Not on your life. They're interested in supersonic transport and other little jokes like that. All we are saying is, couldn't we find it in our heart to give a bit of this intelligence to the improvement of the bullock cart? Where, of course, you can have improvements which now really would help the people to improve the efficiency of this by a factor of 5 or 10, by quite simple means. But it's not happening. I studied all these industries in Asia, and the poor are in many cases using equipment that was antiquated at the time of the Buddha. Nothing had happened. Because of this disease that had infected society, still infecting us, that those who have the immense privilege of education will not use the fruits of education to help the poor, but only to make complications for the rich more and more profuse. That's what we're talking about.
Marcus. Dr. Schumacher, this seems to me a great dilemma. Is it possible to do a job, and I know you regard this as a dirty word, is it possible to do a job which one is paid by a large organization in order to try to live creatively despite that job? And this does seem to me a very great dilemma which faces many millions of people. I'd be most grateful for an answer on that.
You mustn't say such things as if I consider the word job a dirty word. I don't. I'm simply saying it doesn't cover the subject. The real subject is work. And I do say that we should not get it in our minds that the only chance we have to do work is if we're working for an employer and have a job. That's all I mean. Yes, we are always, and are bound to be, this is part of the education of life, in certain situations of a degree of compulsion. Life has not been arranged. Don't blame it on me, but it has not been arranged so that we can always pick and choose the ideal thing. So we are most likely, for certain parts of our lives, going to be, or in my case have been, in situations where we have to do a job that isn't precisely what we want, and there are many things that we don't even really approve of, etc. It's an excellent learning situation. And the art of it is to utilize this as well as one can for one's own real understanding and development. There's always something to be learned. There's a lot to be learned from the difficulties, more from the difficulties than from the ease of life. So here again, if this is really a bad situation, and one really feels this is a waste of time, one's task is to make it still a fruitful situation. And then perhaps prepare very quietly some alternative. I think that... Well, of course, the first thing one would have to do is to gain a little bit of free time. If one goes out to do that, one finds one has bags and bags of time to do at least 2 jobs. And the easiest way to gain a lot of time is to abolish the television. People come to me and say, well, I haven't got time, and when I look into it, I find they're spending about 4 or 5 hours a day looking at the ogle box. That is the first thing, you see, get these things sorted out in one's mind. And then one finds there is plenty of time. I mean, work it out. There are 168 hours in the week. And only 40 hours, the 40-hour week, you know. So what do you do with the other 128 hours? That's the question. That's plenty of time. So you can always write the real thing on the back of the job you have to do. This is perfectly honorable. The 40 hours belong to the employer. Of course, if you are asked to do dirty things, then you say, I'd rather starve than do that. But normally, you're not asked to do dirty things, you're simply asked to do silly things. Well, one can put up with that, you know. In other words, let's have a relaxed attitude about these things, but a conscious attitude. That we know exactly that this is not the right job, but we don't indulge in the luxury of suffering from that. You say, no, therefore, I have now to utilize this. Because a living, if the job is your living, that's not to be sneezed at.
One more short question.
You talk of return to wholeness. Do you see that in a cyclic sense or in an evolutionary unfolding sense? Do you
return to what?
You talk of a return to a sense of wholeness, so to the sense of our forefathers. Do you see that as a cyclic process or evolutionary process?
Well, one might just as well end such a session with a bang rather than a whimper. The greatest destructive force in Western civilization has been the abuse of the word evolution. If we could have just a couple of years where we will not use the word, we might recover from this terrible disease. What do we mean by evolution? There are certain facts which are not controversial, namely that living substances have a certain facility of adapting to changing circumstances. Out of this interesting and fascinating discovery, modern man, who had only one desire to get rid of the Almighty, has made a theory that everything has just come by itself, from chance and necessity, which the 19th century accepted with tremendous relish, because it meant getting rid of the headmaster, and you could then do what you liked. And the 20th century made an even greater error. They thought this was science. But it has nothing to do with science. It's just a completely absurd, in fact, schizophrenic interpretation of the evidence. It is true that there is this power of this adaptability. But there is absolutely no evidence of any kind that suddenly something emerges out of nothing. If in fact, you know, Mozart or Shakespeare is an accidental collocation of atoms, then anything is possible. Then, you know, then it is quite stupid for us to teach our children that 2 and 2 is 4, because why shouldn't it be 400? If something comes out of nothing, without any creation behind it. So, I come back to this. This is not an evolutionary thing. It's got nothing to do with evolution. It's taking the wrong road. It is deserting the truth. That is what happened to Western civilization. It's the great Western deviation. So we have to find our way back to truth. There's no cycle about it. There's no evolution about it. This is all nonsense. The point is that we have to realize we have fallen and we have to get up again. And let's send all the professors home and make them do something useful, if possible, on stage 1 technology. And stop befogging our minds with these far-fetched notions, these absurdities, as if something simply arises out of nothing, as if there was some evolutionary process that took care of what are our jobs to do, as if there was a new generation that was suddenly endowed by evolution with things that had never existed before, and all this stuff. No, let's be humble shoemakers. Get the best leather we can find and make the best shoes we can find.